Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
G'day and welcome to The Call, 10 stocks picked by you, two experts, 1 hour. It is Thursday, the 2nd of May. I'm Andrew Gagan. Great to have you with us here at AusBiz. Our two experts on today's show, Daniel Tizzi from Stock Doctor and Kevin Robinson from Team Invest Private. Welcome to both of you gentlemen on, well, as we still digest, obviously, what the Fed had to say early this morning, our time, and those comments from Jerome Powell, perceived by the market as being, well, somewhat less hawkish than expected. Kevin, what was your takeout from that, and has it altered your view as to where it's likely to go with interest rates in the States?
For me, I don't think it's altered my view, which is interesting. I don't really know for sure whether they're, you know, going to go up or down. But I need to have a read of it a bit more and think about it a bit more. As you say, the market certainly interpreted it as less hawkish, which is an interesting thing. So I know there's also been talk in here in Australia about whether the Reserve Bank is going to put interest rates up or down as the next move, and I think there are people on both sides. So I'm not changing my mind about things at this stage.
But what is your mind? How is it set just in terms of what you're seeing in the equity market at the moment?
Well, my mind is I don't look at interest rates too much except to see how it affects individual businesses that we're looking at. And I think, obviously, inflation does seem to be calming down a little, which I think is probably good news. So we are in a higher interest rate environment than we used to be, a higher inflation environment than we used to be. And so it's a matter of staying with those businesses that have pricing power and are well-run businesses in order to, you know, so that they can navigate whatever comes up the best.
Daniel, what was your take? Given what you heard there, have you altered your view at all? Are you staying the course? How's it informing your investment decisions?
Yeah, Andrew, from an equity point of view, I think, you know, we've had enough chats to know that we've been relatively defensive. And, you know, we're starting to see now further evidence of earnings updates, which are a bit disappointing as well, locally and in the US. So in regards to interest rates, we were always in the camp for higher for longer, especially when we had 7 cuts priced for the start of the year. You know, we were never a believer in that story at all. And I think you're going to start to see a few companies, you know, a bit weary in their guidance now, which has been the case so far, calling out potentially not as positive as they were a quarter ago based on, you know, perhaps steady interest rates. I mean, the market initially rallied in the US because Jerome Powell was saying, effectively, you know, ruling out another rate hike, which some people perhaps were starting to consider. But I think that, like you mentioned, that hawkish stance and, you know, higher for longer is starting to play in the pricing of risk assets.
All right. So as we digest that, and also that's obviously, as Daniel says, digesting those earnings results too, and we're getting more updates locally. We'll get across a couple of them today. The first 5 stocks we're going to take a look at: Corporate Travel, Nick Scali, TechOne, PointsBet, and Woolies. Stock of the day is NAB. It is planning to buy back shares worth $1.5 billion, despite posting a 13% drop in first half cash earnings. The bank point to high operating costs and competition for the drop. Australia's biggest business lender saw cash earnings for the 6 months to March come in at $3.55 billion, in line with consensus. NAB's net interest margin, which is a closely watched measure of profitability, fell to 1.72% from 1.77% a year earlier, declared an interim dividend of 84 cents a share. So interesting that it looks like last year's margin boost has been eroded by that competition we're seeing in the sector. Daniel, what are your thoughts? Well, NAB's group cash profit there down to $3.5 billion, and 12.8% on the year prior, down 3% compared with the second half of 23. Return on equity down more than 13% from a year ago. What did you make of the result?
Yeah, the banking results are hard to digest, Andrew. They're 130 pages, so I'm not going to pretend I've had an amazing read through at this point. But just from a headline level, what was obvious was that, like you mentioned, mortgages and personal banking continues to be very, very tough. Obviously, competition is rife, and we've actually preferred NAB. We've had NAB as a higher weight in our portfolios, our income portfolios, relative to the other big four, because we thought the environment for business banking was a lot more positive. From a banking point of view than the mortgage market. So that was good to get a bit of positive confirmation on that. Certainly the results from their business banking segment were obviously a lot more attractive and appealing than what it was from the personal banking segment. But we're continuing to see not necessarily higher provisions and impairments, but we're seeing higher obviously percentage of people in arrears in the 30 and 90 days, and clear stress, particularly when they I saw data in the credit card market as well. So I'm not very, very positive on the local economy. I think that higher interest rates eventually will wear through and cause some elevated stress levels, but we're not seeing that priced in from an impairments or a provisions point of view from the banks yet. So, I would say on the balance of things, if you're looking to outperform the market, I'd probably be reducing banking exposure heavily. But we have had a preference for NAB against its peers in our income portfolio, that's for sure.
So if you have the stock, you'd hold it?
Yeah, we're happy to hold, preferably for looking for that income. But if you're thinking about outperforming the market, Andrew, I wouldn't be holding this stock.
Fair enough. Okay, Kevin.
Yes, I agree with Daniel. I mean, NAB is not one of the shares that we've been looking at, and the main reason here is because their return on capital is very low, and the stability of earnings and sales growth is not very high for us. So that's what we like to see. And in fact, we haven't been looking at any of the major banks for quite a while now for all of those reasons. And I think NAB is probably better placed than others for the reasons Daniel outlines, in that it's got a greater part of its business in business banking rather than the more competitive these days mortgage market, which is probably good for NAB. But if you look at NAB compared to, say, Westpac and CBA, if you look at their return on equity, both of the other two have higher returns on equity, and their earnings per share growth is very similar in profile, in that they're not essentially going up. They sort of go up and down and stay stable. So that's the reasons we wouldn't sort of look at these banks very much at all.
Okay, so okay. I'll take that as a no then.
Yes, you can take that as a no.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think all of the banks, you notice the CEOs in all of the banks have been saying recently about people who are in trouble, they say, get hold of us quickly. So that might be telling of the times, I don't know. But it's an interesting thing. And the NAB CEO was no different. He inserted a little statement there, anyone in trouble, get hold of them quickly and come to some arrangement.
Yes, right. Of course, he's only newly installed too, so interesting times for him. Obviously, more challenging than his predecessor. All right, let's get into the stocks as picked by you. The first one is Corporate Travel Management. This one picked by Heather, who says it's down 20% in a few weeks with no news. Is that an overreaction of the realization of no rate cuts, perhaps? First half revenue earnings were lower. And has lost some market share, particularly in Australia and New Zealand. So, Kevin, what are your thoughts, and in particular to that question, I guess, given it has come off a lot just in the past couple of months?
The share price has come off a lot.
Yep.
We tend to look at the quality of the business first rather than the share price, and if the share price offers opportunities, then we like that. So, in general, if as Buffett says, if you're a net buyer, you want the price to be low. this is an interesting one for us because it doesn't actually meet our profiles for various reasons. And the big reason it doesn't meet our filters is COVID. And it was the travel disruption, the big travel disruption during COVID. This company, though, does seem to be overall, the last couple of years, seems to be recovering from the COVID problems very well, notwithstanding, as you say, the recent pullback. And they have been buying back shares, as you say. Now, buying back shares, we think, is a good idea when the shares are cheap. And obviously, cheap is a judgment call. They obviously believe that's cheap. If you're a holder, that is, it's a good idea to buy them back. I would say they've done very well during COVID as well, which indicates the strength of management because they didn't do any capital raisings for survival. They did a capital raising for an opportunistic buy of travel and transport in 2000. It's interesting to note that just the other day, just 2 days ago, I think they announced that Kevin O'Malley is stepping down in the US for Anita Salvatore. Now, Anita's been there since 2016. Kevin, I think, came over with the travel and transport, so he's US-based. So I would say for me, and this is interesting because it doesn't meet our filters, but quite a number of our members hold it because it was an excellent company with excellent growth profiles before COVID. I would say for me it's a hold. I'm watching it and to see if it returns to the same sort of growth profile it had before COVID.
All right, interesting take on it. Daniel?
Yeah, I really like when we get the questions from the viewers as well, Andrew. So, you know, good observation. I would say it's probably never a positive sign from market confidence when stocks are, you know, finding trouble to get support just before a result. And I think that's probably, I think that's deserved for corporate travel, to be honest. Their first half result was quite poor, missed expectations significantly by around 15%. And what we did see was that once it missed expectations, it really started, you know, perpetrating a longer term growth story and putting up quite ambitious targets, which, you know, tends to be, in my experience, more of a distraction offered by management teams. And I think what people have started to digest is that, you know, the volume-based incentives in corporate travel's business, which famously were covered quite well in the VGI short report, I think people are starting to have concerns that that's going to trickle on to the second half. And they also had a massive revenue and profit boost from humanitarian travel, from obviously the conflicts between Ukraine and Russia. So I think there's a few things working against them and that they probably are a good chance to disappoint for the full year results. So purely on valuation at this point, you know, I would say, you know, perhaps you're holding in there if you're a long-term holder, but I would actually have a preference for a few other travel names and probably looking to exit corporate travel just because of that nature of their business.
So am I calling that a hold or a sell from you then?
No, I'd probably call it a fence sitting, Andrew, but on the basis of things, I think if this is in my portfolio, I'd be selling.
Yep. Okay. No, well, that's your opinion. That's what we want. All right. Let's move on now into retail, in particular furniture retailer Nick Scali. And this one picked by Les. Written sales gained momentum in the first half and had higher gross margins, lower costs also. Did you come up with an acquisition of Fab Furniture? As it entered the UK market there. Daniel, give us your view then on Nick Scali.
Yeah, fascinating acquisition, Andrew. It reminded me a lot of the Lavisa deal in Europe. I think it was Beeline or B something, that the business that they acquired for, you know, nothing nominally, but taking on all the leases and debt as a low-cost method to effectively, you know, increase their store footprint in Europe. So, you know, interesting to see Nick Scali do the same. Looking at just the metrics in terms of operating metric per store and the overall furniture market, clearly Australians love to spend a lot more on furniture per capita than what the UK and what England people do. We have, you know, they have effectively double the population, but maybe 50% more in terms of spending in that segment. And what we see there is a deterioration, I would say, in kind of store quality and returns. You look at Fab Furniture, they generate much lower gross margins per store, much lower revenue per store, despite, you know, the population being, what, three times as much. So I would say it's going to require a lot of faith and trust in management to effectively turn around that business. And they are looking to reformat it and rebrand it as Nick Scali Stores, which, typically if you start to see that in, I would say an underperforming brand or a brand which with not much customer love or attention is acceptable and understandable. But what we actually saw is if you look at customer reviews and just some of the qualitative data of Fab Furniture, it's actually relatively positive. So it's very hard to figure out whether this is, just a sign of the times in England, whether this is, more of a cyclical downturn for their business or if it was just mismanaged, et cetera. But I would say it's going to be hard to replicate what they've done, for example, with Plush, which has been excellent so far. If you look at the improvement that they had in the cost of doing business, the improvement that they had in gross margins and the efficiency they've had in turnover, I'm just concerned that they won't be able to replicate that in the UK. So, I was probably going to say it's a bit of a sell just on macro risk and, a concern around peak earnings for the company at this time, but that acquisition has probably made me a little bit more concerned. So fantastic business. I'm sure Kevin will touch on a lot of the fantastic metrics. We've loved it for a long time and held it for a long time previously because of those metrics. But for now, I'd actually be out of the stock.
All right. That's a sell from you, Kevin.
That's my segue. Thanks, Daniel. yes, indeed. We are similar in that we've been following this for quite a long time. It's been an excellently run business in Australia. With basically it passes our filters very well, except interestingly for debt to equity, and that's largely because of the change in accounting rules from 2020, bringing leases in because they do have leases. Having said that, they do operate their leases very well, and very, they're good operators of their leases. They just today, this morning, announced the share purchase plan for retail shareholders. So that's interesting. It's a fairly standard as far as I can see. I haven't read it yet, so I'll assess that as to whether I want to go into it or not. As Daniel points out, though, the move into the UK, for me, pushes up the risk profile of this business, and I'd like to keep an eye on that. They're saying that they expect the gross margin and the net margins to be lower than in Australia. And the reason they give it is, or one of the reasons they give certainly, is because of the greater prevalence of interest-free loans offered in Britain than in Australia, which is interesting thought. But they say they feel that they can bring the margins up from where they are now and make it profitable. Remains to be seen. So we'll see how that goes. So that's for me. I'm watching, I'm holding and watching, and I'll assess the SPP and see whether I think that's worth going into as I get a chance to read more of it.
Well, and also obviously that move into the UK, as you both pointed out. All right, that's Nick Scali. Let's move on now to Technology One. This one picked by Marcus. It is the software company, provides a global SaaS ERP solutions, essentially. And first half results there are due out a little later this month, in fact. With some brokers feeling perhaps the market's overestimating its ability to maintain revenue growth at its current levels, given its near historic highs, has certainly been one of those market darlings in the past. Kevin, what's your view on Technology One?
This has been one that we've watched for a long time and has been one of our favourites for a long time, and it's certainly one of my best performers. I've been holding it for quite a while. The trick with this one is to get it at a good price. And yes, right, it has been performing very well in the past. This is another one where the risk profile has gone up a little recently because Ed Chung has taken over as CEO not long ago. Having said that, he has been in the business for a long time. And Adrian DeMarco, who's now still invested in the business but no longer active in the business, either on the board or in management, he nominated Ed to be his successor, which was good. The other thing is they've had changes of the board, and they've got a new chairman there in Pat O'Sullivan. Personally, I'm hoping that he doesn't fall into the temptation of putting on too many professional, and I put professional in quotations, board members, you know, the kind of board members that collect board memberships and really don't understand completely the business and don't have skin in the game. I'd like to see board members with skin in the game. And the other risk factor, of course, a bit older now, is they have moved into the UK. They focus on their market very well with providing the ERP systems, which is where they have been very successful. They know their market. They continually research their systems and develop them. They spend about 20% of their revenue on research and development, which is excellent. Now, the thing about the UK market is it does seem to be successful so far for them, and it's obviously a much larger market than the Australian market. So potentially they could do well. There may be ups or downs, but it has some factors that have increased its risk profile to my mind. And the price at the moment for me is too high, the PEs, so I'm holding and watching.
A hold then from you, Daniel.
Yeah, look, Technology One, I put it in a similar basket to Nick Scali, where they're perennial box tickers. Like, you look at the metrics, the capital efficiency, the ownership, founder-led businesses, like they're so attractive and have done so well for a long time. But the question, I guess, as an analyst, you always have to ask yourself is, well, where to from now and what's the market expecting? And similar to what Kevin mentioned, I do think what you mentioned, Andrew, I do think perhaps the market expectations are a bit too high. So since Adrian's left the business, they've had this kind of constant goal of doubling every 5 years or growing by 15% per annum, which in the markets that they operate in is always going to be a challenge. Like their main customers are obviously local government, then it's education, and then it's, you know, larger government, federal government, et cetera. So those aren't traditionally large growth markets. The way they extract growth is typically through obviously winning new tenders, new proposals for software providing, and they've done a really great job of that locally. I think the government, you know, really likes to work with TechOne because they like to support local players rather than, you know, the global giants like SAP, and there's clearly still market share for them to win, but I think it's just going to get incrementally tougher and, you know, most likely encourage more acquisitive behavior. They have, you know, $200 million in cash. I would think not much at all, if any, corporate debt, and they've been flagging acquisitions for a while. So I think when you pivot from that really strong, you know, compound organic growth to focusing more now on acquisitions, it, you know, in my opinion, dilutes the quality of the business. And I think, you know, that's why for us, we're happy to kind of be on the sidelines for now. But like Kevin mentioned, everything has a price, and, you know, it's currently trading at around 50, 60 times forward earnings. If that was to fall back something in line with, you know, an objective corp, now we'd be more than happy to be buying back into this stock. But for now, even if I held this stock, I'd actually be selling and buying objective corp. I think there's better risk reward there.
Okay. All right. Moving on now to PointsBet Holdings. This one is brought to us by Alex. It is a corporate bookmaker with operations in Australia, North America, and Ireland. It's developed a scalable cloud-based wagering platform, essentially, and it's been a bit of a tale of woe, as you can see there, more recently. In fact, its March quarter update, well, that was positive, highlighted by a 20% increase in Australian net wins, resulting in 24% growth for group net wins. Overall, though, Daniel, how do you rate it?
No, I couldn't help but chuckle, Andrew, when you hear how companies paint themselves. Would you say a software-enabled bookmaker? What was the comment?
Well, depends how you look. Scalable cloud-based wagering.
There we go. Yeah. Look, I think, impressive. Unfortunately, it does sound impressive. It's almost as sexy as Drone Shield. But no, look, PointsBet, unfortunately, this is an industry where, you know, it was a US perpetrated growth story, obviously. And, you know, they had, you know, some fantastic advertisers join them as well, if you look at the personnel that they had advertising with them. But it's a very difficult market. And you look at the US, the plays that they were up against, you know, I was never a fan of PointsBet because I thought the amount of capital that these players are going to spend on marketing, large US giants, I can't envision PointsBet being able to compete. And obviously, as the capital markets winded down from those, you know, crazy areas in 2021 and 2020, you know, that they looked to sell, they sold their US business to a large US company. So the chart on screen, those large dips on the day, that they were capital returns from the US sale. And credit to them, they did return, I think, in total, you know, close to 400 or just over 400 million to shareholders. But I went back and looked at the capital raising schedule, and since 2019, they raised well over $1 billion. So, yeah, to me, that's the story of PointsBet. And now what they're left with, a Canadian and an Australian bookmaking business, well, we know just from looking at results from Flutter and Sportsbet, from Entain, sorry, and also looking at Tabcorp, this is just a really tough industry at the moment. So I wouldn't want to be in PointsBet at all. I'm giving a lot of sells today. Geez, I'm being a bit negative, but I would actually be moving on from PointsBet as well. I understand there's potential for consolidation, and you know there is a necessity for consolidation because these smaller players won't be able to last out given the increasing costs and competition and difficulty of the industry. So yeah, potentially acquisition on the cards, but it's not really where I'll be playing at the moment, Andrew.
All right. I'd actually take it then your readers are harder than a sell. It's an avoid, essentially, from you. Really, $1 billion in capital raisings. That's quite extraordinary.
I've got the schedule, and this is just painting an amazing picture of the capital market. So IPO 2019, $75 million.
Yeah.
$122 million only 3 months later, then $350 million in September 2020, $400 million in August 2021, and then we get to modern day times, $95 million in June 24. So we just saw the absolute explosion and craze of the capital markets during those years, and yeah, those days are well and truly over.
Yeah, wow. All right, Kevin.
Yes, what more can I say, really? I agree with Daniel. This company doesn't meet any of our filters. It's the listed time is too short, and it's never made a profit as a listed company. And as Daniel says, you know, you can look at the capital, the shares on issue, and they just keep going up and up. So as far as I can tell, PointsBet is betting on its investors continually tipping in more money. So it's an avoid from me as well.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's pretty damning then. And I guess that's certainly reflected in what we've seen from the share price in recent times. All right, let's round out the first half with Woolies. This is off the back of its latest update to the market, posting a 2.8% increase in March quarter sales to $16.8 billion, while online sales surged more than 17% on the prior corresponding quarter. Sales for its Australian supermarkets grew by 1.5% in March, compared with the more than 5% growth achieved by its rival Coles. And Chief Executive Brad Banducci saying there had been a substantial shift in consumer behaviour since Christmas as those cost of living pressures certainly hit consumer spending. Elsewhere, the company's Big W store suffered a 4.1% fall in sales to $1 billion compared with the same period a year ago. And also, of course, recently, I think it was yesterday, sold 5% of its 9.1% shareholding in Endeavour. Kevin, what are your thoughts?
Yes, it's a company that, again, it's another one that doesn't match our filters. I mean, we all know what it does. There's very high debt at 245% debt to equity on our calculations. And that means that although the return on equity is good for us, the return on capital is below our accepted 10%. Also, the earnings growth stability growth is not that great, and the growth is not high. It's had a difficult time with Big W, you know, trying to make a profit out of that. And it has had a technical loss in the most recent half year due to impairment of goodwill in New Zealand and mark-to-market considerations with their Endeavour shares, because they sold those down. So now they no longer have a significant influence ownership. So that affects the way they account. They have to account under accounting standards for their mark-to-market. So technically it's a loss for the last half year. But overall, fundamentally, it doesn't have a strong growth trajectory. The net margins, which is interesting, it's been an issue recently. The net margin is about 2.5% thereabouts. When you compare it to something like Nick Scali, where the net profit margin, if I recall off the top of my head, is well over 20%, you wonder why certain interests are complaining about the net profit margin of supermarkets, because it would take very little price increase in either labor costs or produce costs to put them into a loss. So if they couldn't pass it on to the consumers, which is what people are complaining about. But it's an interesting exercise. For me, I would say no. I would say sell. It doesn't meet any of our filters.
Mm, okay. Daniel.
Yeah, we should package that up and send it to the Green Senator, I think, Andrew. And then the only metric, Kevin, you didn't touch on is return on equity. What is your return on equity? So, look, I think this is almost a perfect storm of negativity for Woolworths. And the analysts were expecting a bad quarterly result. I think that's, you know, partially intentional by them. You know, they don't want to be perpetrating any form of good news right now. And you know, even just the cost escalations that they're talking about in their capital programs and warehouses, etc. You know, now's the perfect time to announce it when you got all the bad news. So I would actually be a bit more opportunistic on Woolies. I think, you know, these businesses clearly are very dominant, and they're going to continue to grow by low single digits for a long, long time and at least carry some protection to inflation. So I'm actually relatively positive on the supermarkets. I think Woolies is trading at a more attractive valuation than Coles at this point, which is hardly ever the case throughout their listed history together. You know, you're not getting a great yield at the moment. It's about gross 5%. So that's including franking. But over time, I think you will start to see shareholders appreciate the defensiveness of something like a Woolworths. So part of my you know, positivity to the company is the fact that I think equity markets are in for a tougher 12 to 18 months, and I wouldn't be surprised to see something like Woolies outperform. But, you know, it's just got to be a return to normality, a return to, I guess, some form of sense in terms of public opinion and whatnot, because, yeah, Kevin pointed out all the right metrics. I would point out we look at, you know, ROA of around, I think, 6 or 7%, and the reason why it's return on equity so high is because they just have really large asset turnover or inventory turnover, which, you know, is a big driver of ROE as well with leverage. So I'm actually thinking that the returns outlook from here look pretty good. Certainly be holding in the portfolio, but if you're an income investor, I would actually be adding to my position on today's fall.
Yeah, right. In fact, that's probably the most positive one you've had thus far then, but I mean, given also where it's fallen to.
And unexpected, I would have time. Said.
No, I could see that coming. All right, let's round out where we've been for the first half of the show there. And our stock of the day, NAB, which reported today. Daniel, well, of the big four, it's his preference. However, he's got a whole lot to be said. He really doesn't want to be in that space. So, you know, in fact, he'd probably sell it. Whereas Kevin, yeah, he's just not interested for the same reasons, given they're not interested in the big banks at the moment. But they both make the point, though, that NAB's probably got the advantage because of its growth in business banking as compared with that, particularly the mortgage growth that's become more and more competitive. Corporate travel, it is a hold from Kevin. It's a sell from Daniel. He thinks it's likely to disappoint in terms of further results there. Nick Scali, the furniture retailer, was a sell from Daniel. Wary of particularly that the fab furniture business has picked up in the UK. Kevin also making that point, but does say generally, though, an excellent run business. He's got a hold on it. Technology One, a hold from Kevin. And a sell from Daniel. PointsBet, well, you sum that up with an avoid from both, essentially. And just finally there, Woolies, a sell from Kevin, whereas Daniel will have a hold, potentially an add, given, you know, the possible opportunity we're seeing there, given that actually the share price has fallen quite considerably. All right, let's catch up with our High Conviction Fund, picked by Investment Committee. The latest episode of that's live here to watch at AusBiz.com. Checking in on the update, going into May, the committee sold Domino's, Santos and Evolution Mining and added Southern Cross Media Group, Sonith Healthcare and Aristocrat Leisure. ResMed was trimmed by 1%, Premier Investments by 1.5% and Cash Holdings raised to 5% from 2%. In terms of its performance, it is up just over 28% on a cumulative return basis. It's inception in March 2022. So keep your requests coming in. Keep the call switched on to see which stocks our committee will be looking at next. Second half of the show, we're going to take a look at Seven West Media, WiseTech Global, Viva Energy, Mineral Resources, and Core Lithium. So to Seven West Media, this one picked by Lou, he's saying there's a lot of bad news surrounding executive departures, but is it looking like good value? First half earnings were largely in line, given it was another tough year for the TV market, particularly the linear market there, with ad markets expected to be down about 10 to 15%, in fact. So let's see what our experts have to say. Kevin, yeah, it has been a lot of very negative press coming out of Seven, in particular in relation to the fallout from the Lerman trial and subsequent court proceedings as well. What do you make of it?
Yes, it's interesting. Obviously, as you say, I think the Lerman trial thing has fostered a lot of negative sentiment, certainly, and that's reflected. I mean, we calculate the PE ratio at about 4.3, so that's probably reflecting in that. Having said that, it doesn't meet our filters. It's got too much debt, and the stability of earnings growth is not high enough for us to look at. So we can't be, from that point of view, we can't be confident that earnings per share will grow significantly in the future, that we can depend on that. And yes, you're right, it is a very tough time for these traditional media businesses, broadcast media businesses. So yes, for us, for me personally, I would say sell on this one if you're holding it.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's pretty plain. Daniel, do you see any positivity there at all?
I've got the loaded cannon waiting, Andrew.
No. Just as look, well, Koshy's not sitting in here, I should say.
Yeah, I was about to say.
Yeah,
it's very fortunate timing. Perhaps it was intentional by the team at Ausbiz. But look, the thing with Seven West Media is that this is just, and most media companies that we have on the ASX, the radio companies as well, they're just super leveraged. So when we see, you know, advertising budgets go up, expenditure increasing, we just see massive leverage in earnings. And we saw that, you know, a couple of years ago during really strong, obviously, zero interest rates. Everyone was looking to grow. Capital was being raised everywhere. What do you spend it on? You spend it on advertising. So you know, you just saw the huge operating leverage there, a few dividends being returned by Seven West and, you know, really good share price performance. Now we just have the opposite. We have the unwind now. And, you know, the leverage in this is outstanding. I think it was about a 6% revenue decline and around a 60% EPS decline. So, you know, you don't get that leverage anywhere else other than perhaps, you know, Aussie property, mortgaging Aussie property. So I think it's just too risky. They have 250 mil of net debt, which is about three quarters of its market cap. And the interesting thing about that is that it's in a much better position than it has been historically. It used to have a lot more net debt. So yeah, I just think it's way too risky. If you're a trader and you have really good coverage and outlook on the advertising market, you can absolutely clean up with these businesses. But you know, that's not what we do at Stock Doctor and not how we like to play the market, Andrew. So it's just a complete avoid.
Yep. Okay. Well, that's a bit damning. Then the view on Seven West Media. Let's move on into tech, specifically WiseTech. This one picked by John. It is a provider of software solutions for the logistics industry globally, at least. And just its most recent, well, its first half performance there saw lower cost growth with a focus on some recent acquisitions as well. Daniel, talk us through WiseTech.
Yeah, well, WiseTech, surprisingly, given what I've said about, you know, valuations in the past for a few stocks, WiseTech is a darling in my eyes and in the market's eyes. And you know, I just think this business continues to really surprise people with how much it can actually grow. The CargoWise product, we know over time has become industry standard. I think it has 13 of the top 25 freight forwarders on its platform. It's acquiring little businesses along the way to add products, add customers, and just continue to grow that networked effect. And it trades on a crazy multiple, 80 times earnings, which, you know, people kind of balk at. But you know, at least with the growth outlook for WiseTech, I can understand it. They have a huge ability to penetrate still the large freight forwarders. And as an industry, like, this is obviously, as we all know, this is massive. It drives global commerce. And the industry has been, you know, very poor from a technology or software perspective in the past. And I used to work in M&A and working with logistics providers in the past. Their, you know, their accounting, their software, their systems are really, really bad, worse than probably what most people would expect. It's amazing that things get delivered on time, and most of the fact they probably don't. So I still likewise, if you don't own in your portfolio, I would actually say it's a buy today, even at these levels, just to get that exposure for the long term, because the growth outlook is there in my eyes, the penetration is there. And the best thing is that, you know, CargoWise as a product, you know, charges about 50 basis points on average for these companies as revenue. So I think over time, there's huge scope for price increases as well, which will just add large incremental earnings, like a, you know, like an REA type setup. So I think if it's not in your portfolio, get it in there. Otherwise, if you've got it in there, it's a hold, but just a massive fan of this business.
Clearly, the outstanding stock on the list today, as far as you're concerned. Kevin, do you agree?
I agree in terms of business fundamentals, yes. I think, yeah, as Daniel says, it's an excellent company. Wyatt himself, Richard Wyatt, is a really good operator. He's got a great idea of making global freight forwarding much more efficient, much easier, which it hasn't been in the past. The other thing they're going into now, which is, I think they're just starting it, is looking into doing the same thing in global customs, so streamlining global customs, which is my understanding that no one's done that yet. So that'll be interesting, and that's potentially another area of growth for them. We do watch this. It hasn't quite got our desired 10 years of listed history. So for the most part, we're watching it and keeping an eye on the business. And the other thing is, as Daniel says, the PE ratio is very high. Now, we make it on our calculation of, we do historical calculation of PE rather than forward estimations. And our historical is about 140 times. So for us, the price is high. I would say, I'm going to say, if you have it, hold, but expect that PE one way or another to come down. So either the earnings is going to grow fast enough to make it more desirable, or the price will come off at some point, is what I would say. But yes, it is an excellent, well-run company with great growth prospects.
All right. Well, that was very positive just in regards to WiseTech. So a buy and a hold. Let's now get into Viva Energy. It does supply about a quarter of Australia's liquid fuel through petrol stations, particularly sold under the Shell and Viva Energy brands. Also operates the Geelong refinery as well. Also, and most recently has completed an acquisition of the OTR chain of petrol stations. March quarter saw the Geelong refining margins below forecasts there. Kevin.
Yes, it doesn't meet a lot of our filters. So return on equity is low, return on capital is low, and its stability of earnings is below our filters as well. Having said that, the PE is also quite high for us. 60 for that business, given the low return on equity and so forth, 67 we make it in our historical PE calculations. Retailing of petrol and fuel products is a tough business, very thin margins. I used to actually work in the business, and interestingly, a couple of years ago, I was at a trade show and saw some of the old Shell guys there, and they were talking about decommissioning a system, a computer system that I was involved in putting in place in the first place. It was a SAP system. So that was an interesting little bit of history there for me. But yes, so for us as investors, this is not one. This is one we would avoid for all those reasons I mentioned.
All right. How do you look at a potential peer in terms of Ampol? Would you sort of, is it similar?
I think it is similar. I haven't really looked at Ampol as such, but I think it's probably similar because they're facing all very much the same sort of the same sort of forces, market forces, and the same thin margins.
Yep.
The refining is also difficult because, you know, they've got the refinery in Geelong. Viva has the refinery in Geelong. It's difficult because it's not a really large refinery. In world scale, you get these really huge refineries in places like Singapore that, you know, pump out huge amounts of product, and they've got the economies of scale. So running the Geelong refinery is also a difficult thing for them. Refineries are funny things as well in that if you want to decommission one, it often costs a lot more than just to keep it running marginally. So, yeah, that's a bit tough. So I think, yeah, Ample similar as far as I can tell, having not really looked into it in depth.
All right. Daniel?
Yeah, they've been really good businesses to be in the last few years, Andrew, since a lot of its competitors and refiners in Australia have exited the market since COVID. And, you know, really the government stepped in to say, hey, we want to keep some refining onshore to secure our supply. And the only two operators in that space now are obviously Ampol and Viva, like you've mentioned. So, I mean, one thing which a lot of people have actually spoken about is a bit of a difference now is that the government has effectively agreed to backstop, you know, any losses through volatile refining margins. So, you know, we've seen in the past when refining margins per barrel, you know, drop for whatever reason, could be increased supply, you know, shocks to demand, lower demand like it was during COVID, you know, the government's actually signed an agreement to step in and backstop it and fund losses. So I think that's actually a really material event for these businesses, which is probably coming to light now. Like, we're starting to see the valuations as a whole for these companies improve. I think that's one reason why, because it's obviously reducing risk. And the second thing is that, like Kevin mentioned, historically, like, the convenience fuel business has not been a great business. And what that has meant is that Ampol and Viva have been able to consolidate their position significantly through acquisitions, and acquisitions at what I would say are very cheap prices, and therefore the returns on capital have actually improved, and they're looking quite good, excluding some of the volatile earnings from refining margins. So you look at, like, the relative earnings they're able to extract now versus pre-COVID on similar levels of volume, and it has improved. And I would say that's due to scale. It's due to their ability to obviously consolidate, and they've probably got a bit more bargaining power now with their customers, particularly more in the industrial side and in the commercial side, and rather than the retail side, which I think is why we're seeing these stocks do so well. So Ampol, I do like a bit more. We just think the balance sheet is a little bit clearer on our screens, on our view. So I would actually be a holder of Ampol. If anything, the share price has been reacting to a relatively poor first quarter result. I would almost be a buyer in Ampol, but Viva Energy, I think, is simply a hold. The dividends alone and the propensity for special dividends looks like it's here to stay for the next few years, and I think that's a bit underrated, kind of like what we saw in the coal industry, except the only difference is we didn't have a massive boom of profits like we did in that industry. But the valuations are low, returns therefore are higher for shareholders, and I'd be looking to stay in these companies for now.
Okay, all right. Well, let's now go digging in the resource sector. Mineral Resources is our next one. Picked by Al is a diversified mining services company, essentially, with recently recommenced selling its Wodinga spodumene concentrate in the third quarter. Also, first shipments of its Onslow iron expected in June, I believe. Daniel, give us the rundown.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Mineral Resources. I think you might know Andrew from some stops in the past on Ausbiz. But, you know, I just think the market is clearly worried about the significant investment they've made. And, you know, arguably that's warranted. The balance sheet does look stretched. The good thing is that its maturities are not for a few years, so they have a bit of time. But, you know, they've effectively tripled in size than what they have been in previous years. So they've funded all that now. I would say they're at the tooth's end of that. The significant project, the Ashburton project in iron ore, is about to come online. First ship on ore. First ore on ship in June, and I think that's a major positive. And in the next few years, I would say what's going to happen is you see the volumes just skyrocketing, doubling and tripling in the mining services business. And that obviously underpins a much higher earnings quality because that's, you know, going to be a lot more recurring and stable in nature rather than exposure to commodity prices. So, you know, I've been a buyer of MIN under $60. I'd still call it a buy today. I think big catalyst could be, and the asterisk is the could, the outcome of the sell down of their haul road for the Onslow project. So, you know, some analysts are indicating it could net close to $1 billion, or, you know, gross close to $1 billion before tax. I think that that's probably likely to be, you know, closer to $700-800 million, but that would go a long way in repairing confidence in the balance sheet. And I just think the outlook for iron ore and lithium, you know, remain quite strong, which is their key commodity. So, not big fan of this business. I know it's divisive. A lot of people don't like the management team and Chris Ellison. I'm a big supporter and would call it a buy at today's prices.
Yep. Okay. Kevin.
This is a really interesting business for us because in the past, when it was a pure mining services business, it passed our filters. These days, it doesn't, and it doesn't meet our criteria largely because most of it is now a mining company. Having said that, a lot of our members still hold it, and I agree largely for the most part with Daniel in his assessment. The other thing that occurs to me is that if you invest in this business, you're investing very much in Chris Ellison, as the driving force in the business. And the other thing that we noted when we were looking at it a little while ago in one of our meetings, one of the things that they're very, very good at is forming partnerships, forming working partnerships, and that's what they're looking to do with their haul road for Onslow. Mm. But if you look at their mining, the iron ore versus the lithium, they're much more keen to form partnerships in lithium than they are iron ore. Much more of their iron ore is, you know, the actual mines themselves are wholly owned, which is interesting. Now, my interpretation of that is that they are mitigating what they see as a greater price risk in lithium than iron ore, price and or volume risk. So I thought that was an interesting thing that we sort of looked at. Again, that's my interpretation. Yep. I don't know what the real thinking is.
Let me just pick you up, too, when you said you're essentially investing in Chris Ellison. Is that, do you see that as a positive or negative?
I personally see it as a positive. I think he's very, very entrepreneurial, as long as he remains entrepreneurial. And he has said in the past that he's passing on the entrepreneurship, if you like, to his senior management. Mm. I think that for an investor, I think that's very difficult for us to tell. In a way, the only way you can tell is if he does, and hopefully he doesn't step back. I think he's got a long time to go. But if he steps back to see how the management run it themselves. A bit like a Berkshire Hathaway situation at the moment, perhaps sometime in the future, but I don't know. The other thing, of course, they're moving into is gas, and they're looking for a partnership in their onshore gas in the Perth Basin as well, which is an interesting development.
Yep. So what would you do with it?
Me, I would hold. Mm. Yeah, I would hold. All right. Keep an eye on that capitalization and see what the partnerships do.
All right, well, we were just talking about lithium, so let's round it out with a look at Core Lithium, which has, well, certainly had its troubles. We know where the lithium price has gone in recent times, and the stock has been hit hard as a result. In fact, it paused its production there, and that's saying it depends on market conditions and feasibility work. This was seen as having delivered a decent quarter, certainly beat many broker forecasts there. Kevin, Core.
Over the last 10 years, they've only made a profit in one period. So that definitely wouldn't meet our criteria. So, for me, I'd say there are better lithium plays, Mineral Resources being one. It's not a pure lithium play, obviously. But Core Lithium also do other things. They explore for copper, gold, silver, uranium, and other minerals as well, emphasis being on explore. When you look at their shares on issue, it's an absolutely wonderful graph if it was earnings per share growth. But instead, it's the shares on issue, which indicates they keep dipping into the pockets of their shareholders for more capital all the time. So no, for me, it would be a definite avoid.
Right. Okay. And Daniel, last word to you.
Yeah, well, I think we're just going to kick the can on courts. Never been one I liked, but I did want to touch on one point about men, if I could, just for a second. And Kevin brought up a really, really good point about, you know, the how the business partners with people, and it hasn't done that in iron ore. The reason why it hasn't, and this is just fantastic bit of history, was that, you know, those were terrible projects acquired nominally for like 50, 100 million bucks. And the reason why they're able to run it is because they're generating profits and services. So they are partnering now with their new iron ore project, but that's just the lifeblood of the business and its uniqueness. It makes money through services. It's consistent through services, and it doesn't have to worry about holding the capital in mining projects like traditional miners do. But moving on to core, this has been one which is, you know, obviously very opportunistic in the lithium space. Never liked it. The resource was always relatively poor in quality. When you look at things like grade, you look at things like the metallurgy, and when you rush projects to production, it increases the risk significantly because you don't have confidence on things like the grade profile and the structure of the geology. So in lithium, the main kind of, you know, standard processing technique for recovery is to effectively a gravity circuit or a DMS circuit. And, you know, very similar, Mount Catlin, similar issues to what Core has had. Thin grade mineralization can't recover the material. So even when they were running at high prices, you know, they weren't making much money at all because of that. So yeah, just not interested at all. It's purely a speculative bet on the lithium price at this point, but yeah, not interested in Core.
All right, that sums it up then. Let's take a look at the last five stocks. Seven West Media there, pretty negative. A sell from Kevin, carrying too much debt. Daniel agrees, he's also avoiding it. Wise Tech. A buy from Daniel. He's said it great to get long-term exposure there. And Kevin also saying it does have excellent fundamentals, but he's watching it at this point. He would put a hold on it. Viva Energy, no from Kevin. Low return on equity and capital, he says. Daniel say it has been a good business the last few years, but his preference would be potentially to buy Ampol instead. Mineral Resources, Daniel's most enthusiastic stock of the day. He's got a buy on it, although it does point out the balance sheet does look stretched at this point. And Kevin, yeah, also likes the business, but he would have a hold on it. And finally, their Core, an avoid essentially from both. All right, that is the show. Thank you to our experts. Kevin, thanks for joining us from Team Invest.
Thank you, Andrew.
And Daniel from Stock Doctor, good to see you.
Cheers, Andrew.
All right. And of course, any stocks you'd like us to cover, you can go to ausbiz.co/callpicks, or you can write to us on x@ausbiz.tv. Thanks for watching.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.